Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And you've all heard of Buddha, the Buddha, but many of you don't know much about the Buddha's wife. And it's very important to know about her. As a matter of fact, there's a new book called The Buddha's Wife. And I've loved this book. We should all be reading it because it'll help us manage our lives so much better, as she had to after the Buddha left. After Siddhartha walked out on her, what happened? We want to know. And to help us know better and to help us live in a great Dharma that we're wanting to live, is it one of the authors of The Buddha's Wife, who wrote it with his wife, Janet Suri, and we're speaking today with Samuel Shem. Sam, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that we can talk about this. It's a lifelong work of yours and your wife's, not about the Buddha's wife, but about what she offered the world. And we imagine what she offered the world, too, because your story about her life is fictional, but it's very realistic, right?
Yeah. First of all, I'm sorry my wife of many, many, many years can't be with us on this interview today, but that's the virtue of being co-authors. You can have the other person be here. So I'm here, and this is really mainly Janet's creation, although we're partners. And about 10 years ago or so, Janet, who is a Buddhist teacher and a clinical psychologist, came to me and said, you know, I just read about the Buddha's wife, and it turns out that in all of the early sutras, it stated that the Buddha left his beloved wife on the evening of the birth of their only child, a son, and left without saying goodbye to go out on his great heroic male journey toward awakening. And so we were kind of astonished. And we said, well, what happened to her and right. to the son, whose name, interestingly enough, is Rahula, which in Pali means fetter, like you fetter a horse or something. And we then did very careful research. I mean, this is, and what we came up with was very helpful in many ways. As a novelist, you know, I wrote a novel called The House of God that many of your listeners may have, know about. It's about medical internship. There are only 5 mentions of Yasodhara, the Buddha's wife, in the Pali Canon. And that's helpful to a novelist because there are not much to go on, so you can imagine what happened. But the beginning and the end are very clear. Beginning, middle, and end are very clear. The beginning is the leaving and her terrible grief. The middle is when he comes back just once when his child is 7. He leaves as Siddhartha, her beloved, and comes back as this presence, this Buddha with monks, you know, in a begging bowl. And then the last thing is very interesting. There's a writing that the women, at the, you know, after several years, you know, maybe 10 or something like that, they decided they wanted to, the women of the palace, whom she was with and who came toward her in her suffering, decided that they wanted to join the now famous Buddhist Sangha. So they sent word to Ananda, his assistant, saying they want to join, and the Buddha twice said no. So they shaved their heads, they donned their robes, and these are princes and princesses, you know, et cetera, as well as some servants, donned their robes and marched 200 miles to where he was encamped and met the assistant, Ananda, and said, tell him again. So he goes to tell the Buddha. The Buddha says no, and Ananda says, well, guess what? They're waiting outside. And so he made some rules that kept them separate, but they were technically part of the Sangha. So the first half of the book is the novel based on those facts. And the second half of the book, which really is what you said about helping us now. How is this relevant now? Well, the story of an abandoned woman, an abandoned wife. But what we realized is that we can look at the path that she took and how we elaborated it in the novel as a path of awakening with others. The subtitle of the book is The Path of Awakening Together. And just the last thing I'll say about that is, right now, is that the Buddha took his first step toward awakening out of relationship. He stepped out of relationship, right, to go on this solo journey, sat under the tree, and became enlightened, and then taught it to many, many people. Yasodhara's first step is that her suffering attracts the compassion and care of the other women in the palace. So her first step is more deeply into relationship, and that's what, you know, has always gone on as a path of awakening. Women have always been doing this, but it's never been recognized as a, quote, a real path of awakening. And so that was our goal. So the second half of the book is looking at the ripe moments of her path and how they are reflected in our world today, i.e., how do people work together in awakening to accomplish incredible things in life? And, you know, we give stories, we give examples, and then each chapter also has practices, meditation practices, to build community, to help with relationships, and to make peace in the world.
Yeah, and it's really about how do we interpret what a spiritual path is and what our goals are on the spiritual path. And what really is enlightenment and awakening? Is it through the aloneness and self-reflection that the Buddha asks for, and detachment in that those moments of being at one, but also at one with the universe? And yet, for women, it might not be the same in general. I'm generalizing because men have always been the hunters, and they've always gone out on their own and have more alone time. And women have always had to be those who stay and bring up the children and cook and gather. And and so for women, community is of essence, but not so much for men.
Well, right. Not so much for men, but frankly, from our other work, we wrote a book also together called We Have to Talk, Healing Dialogues Between Women and Men, based on lots of research we did all over the world. If you offer a way for men to be in a good relationship, which is a basic yearning that we come into the world with, both men and women come into the world with a yearning for connection, they'll grab it. So yes, it's, you know, for reasons that are, I don't think, are at all instinctual, but for various reasons, women are valued, put it that way. Women are valued for learning how to be in relationship, for compassion, for care, for concern, children, etc., while men are more valued for, yes, going out, they're more valued for self. And women are more valued for connection. And we're hoping that this will help those genders get together around this.
Right. And also what's interesting to me is, from what I understand about the gender fears, is that women fear being alone. They fear being abandoned. And that's not what men fear. Men actually are designed to provide and protect. So what men fear is the shame of not having done a good enough job by maybe not bringing home enough meat from their hunt.
And, well, I think what we've said previously, and I coined the term in working with men, what men dread, not only fear, what men dread the most, which drives them out of relationship, as all of your women listeners will attest, is something that we coined, where women, if a woman is coming, you know, yearning to make a better relationship, to get closer to a man, that can stimulate something we called male relational dread.
Yes. Right?
And the idea is you freeze up and you want to run away. All men have felt that.
They don't want to talk so much because they're afraid if they're talking that they'll be shamed by it, that they'll be inadequate. And
oh, they have never. I think it's even deeper than that. It's that there's something about a woman really approaching closely that makes men stiffen up. And I think it comes not from innate things. It comes from the way early in life men are told to separate from the relationship with mother. And then what happens is they kind of grow up separate from other relationships. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh, sure.
So it's more complex, but I think all of us have it. All of us have it. But the other thing, but the best thing is we can be redeemed. I mean, it's conditioned. You know, as I say, the second part of the book, let me read you the epigraph, which is really addressing this. It's a lovely thing. The epigraph of the book, right in the front of the book. Let me just tell a little of the story. When the Buddha comes back, he and Yasodhara, his wife, meet for the first time. Imagine, he left as Siddhartha, or Sid, her beloved, and comes back as the Buddha. And they have a conversation, and in the near the end of the conversation, she poses a question in our fictional account. But they did meet, we know that. She says to him, "Dear one, what might have been a benefit, what teaching and practices offered, had two or more sat together under the Bodhi tree?"
In relationship.
Yeah. So, in the second half of the book, one of the central parts is called accompanying others through the circle of life, and this is nonfiction, and it's about devotional vows, right? And there are three parts of that section. One is the devotional vows that mothers and fathers take for, you know, children growing up, born and growing up, and taking vows, you know, to take care of the kids, basically, and accompany them. And then the middle section is called spiritual friendships, which is interesting, and couples work. And the Buddha said, Ananda, his assistant, said to him, Ananda said, because of their friendship, "I think friendship is half of the holy work," Ananda said. And Buddha said, "No, not half, Ananda. Friendship is the whole of the holy work." It's interesting. Very interesting.
Yes, yes.
And then the last part, which for people of my age is very, you know, with older parents, is the devotional vows accompanying others through illness, old age, and death. And there are we're practical people. We think things can get better in the world, right? You do too. So each chapter has, okay, here are the resources. Here is the way to form connections and circles so that you don't have to do it alone, because it's very hard in any of these three phases of life to do it all alone, as everybody knows.
Well, there's an incredible understanding in the story that you wove through the book about Yasodhara and her suffering after she was left behind, that the way that she was connected with by her community of women around her, and actually Siddhartha's stepmother, Pajapati, really was the force of creating these women's circles that brought Yasodhara in. And what is really wonderful to read, because it makes it so real for all of us, I believe, is to see how suffering is held by others. It's not about problem solving, because they could never solve the problem of her suffering directly. Because
right. That's a very wise thing to say. Good for you.
Thank you. Siddhartha was gone.
He was gone. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So
gerund is like arising, or, you know, it's when a noun is used as a verb, but gerunds are very important. Language is very important in this, in that they're in the meeting. We talk about this in her gift of desperation, in the meeting of her suffering The suffering and compassion co-arise. There's an arising in the community of compassion for this horrible thing that's happened to her. Horrible. All of a sudden, out of the blue. So yes, the suffering attracts compassion, and that's the best thing that can happen in life. Because the Buddhists, you know, let me just go back a step. This book is not at all saying there's anything wrong with the Buddha or wrong with Buddhism. You know, we both practice Buddhism. He's absolutely incredible. What it's talking about is a complementary path that's suggested by his teachings, actually, that maybe can come to light, you know, as something is, that people can practice.
To me, the revelations that come from this have to do with the way that we join together in let's call it in circles, because yep. In circles is the most productive way of being with a group of people.
Yep.
And it's, as I said earlier, it's not about the circle problem solving so much as it's being seen and heard within the group with compassion and with love, that you feel connected and supported by the hearts of others, and so you can relax into the structure of the circle and feel supported by it. But it's also something that you talk about in the book, is that it's really understanding that we're only human and
yeah.
we all suffer.
Yeah.
And so in the circle, everybody shares their suffering. Eventually, we hear from everybody, and we find that everyone suffers, and there's no end to suffering, as Buddha said. And so really, it's about having compassion for the nature of life shared together in our hearts and love. And that's really, I think, the enlightenment of it,
yeah.
and that's what lifts us.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, it's pretty simple, actually. In a circle, you are not alone. And, you know, one of the organizations that shows this in our time that we have had great familiarity with and wrote a play about, we wrote a play called Bill W. and Dr. Bob, which ran off Broadway for a year last year, about the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the best, there are lots of examples of what you're saying, but one of the best examples is 12-step programs, because, you know, one of the sayings in 12-step programs is that when you walk into a meeting, you realize, quote, I'm not alone, because you hear somebody else's story that's like your story. And, you know, you identify, you don't compare.
Yeah,
so
you don't see yourself
right.
as
you're not alone.
Right, you don't see yourself as the biggest victim in the universe. You realize that this is a shared path of humanity, and if we can all hold hands and hold each other's hearts, that it makes us stronger.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, we studied with an Indian teacher for quite a while, and I'll never forget one of the very simple things she said, which all teachers say. She said, you know, when you're feeling angry like that, it's not your anger. It's just anger. Right? You're making it yours, but it's anger. That's part of being a human being. You know, it's part of the job. And that's
right.
A very liberating sense, because otherwise you think, oh, it's just me and I'm crazy and I can't control this. If somebody else talks about it, like in the book, you know, one of the things that opens up Yasodhara's heart in the novel is another woman's child dies and she's in the circle. And, you know, all of a sudden, Yasodhara's heart goes out to somebody else instead of being only concerned about her own loss. You know?
Yes, right.
And I did want to reply. The story of the two women, the Buddha's stepmother, Pajapati, who was the queen, and Yasodhara, who was his wife. Pajapati, the Buddha's mother, died, I think, sort of a day or something, or 2 days after his birth. And his mother's sister, Pajapati, took him in. So she knew all about, as it says in the book, Pajapati was experienced in grief. And so she was the one who came because she knew it and helped Yasodhara, you know.
Yeah,
at first, she couldn't
leader.
Even care for her baby, Yasodhara, so they, you know, they took turns, you know.
Right. So yeah. One thing that we're talking about that is really important and is a struggle, I think, for a lot of people is empathy. And I've read research that says that only 20% of the population of this country exhibits empathy.
Wow.
And actually, my feeling about it is that, no, it's really that the empathy is misplaced. And the empathy, because I believe that so many people, most people nowadays, have become very tribal. A lot because of propaganda, because of politics and religion. They've created a lot of fear and tribal mentalities. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a big difference between tribal mentality and collective mentality. And when people are tribal, their empathy is tribal, not personal.
Yeah.
And so,
it's interesting. Let's open this up and be quite frank. Studies have shown, for instance, that, you know, really wealthy people have less empathy.
Right.
And so that, you know, what is that saying? It's saying that if you do buy into, you know, what the Buddha called the three hindrances, you know, hatred, greed, and delusion, that it ain't going to make you, it's going to increase suffering. It's almost bound to increase suffering.
Right.
And it's quite remarkable that we live in such a fractious and fragmented society that is organized into these, you know, a lot of it is organized against what you hate as opposed to
what
you love.
Include.
You know,
yeah.
And one of the things we talk about in a little bit, it's a little funny, but, you know what a bodhisattva is, I'm sure.
It's somebody it's like Yasodhara. It's someone who holds back, who is there to help others.
Exactly. They're on their way toward enlightenment, but they say, no, I'm going to stop before I get fully enlightened and tend to others. And so we had this experience. It's in the book. I don't know if you remember where. When our play was on in New York last year, it was a very hot day. The actors were in revolt. We came down from Boston to New York. We were late. We had to save the day. You know, a lot of pressure on us. We're carrying our bags, sweating. We rushed past this brownstone guy, African-American guy sitting on the steps. He says, hey, got spare change for a homeless Vietnam vet? I say, no. We keep going, you know. He says, shouts out, hey, you two look like you're in a hurry. I say, yeah, we're in a hurry. Then he shouts out, you two too old to be in a hurry. And boom. I mean, you know, New York's great for this. There are a lot of bodhisattvas in New York on the streets, you know, but it just stopped us in our tracks. And we said, hey, wait a second. You know, this is part of life. This is not a big tragedy, you know?
Right.
So you have to, and they're there. They're there if you listen.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I mean, I guess let me just be more serious about it. We all have the experience of encountering not very famous or well-known or even, you know, solid-looking people who turn out to be the most helpful people in terms of their empathic reaction to us. You know,
right.
Like the mental health worker who, you know, is the only one that talks to a mental patient who's in trouble, or you know what I mean.
It's sure, everybody we never knows know that. Where the next opportunity for realization comes from, so we have to be
That's
open
right.
to anything. So,
that's right.
You know, this is so important for people to read this book because it really is clear how we should be paying more attention in life, and it's paying more attention with others, and how to see others and listen to others better, how to be a better presence in life for each other, on that in that larger framework of that we all got, you know, issues, And we all really need compassion, and so let's help each other with it.
Yeah. Well, where did you get such understanding? That's great.
I host a lot of radio shows. So there are a lot of wonderful authors whose books I read, including yours.
I know we're on the air, but you know, I don't have much detail about how to get back in touch with you. I'd love to talk to you more off the air.
I announced that on the show that my email address is peter@heartriver.org.
Okay.
And my phone number is 212-222-7748, because I'm always open to hear from people and love to talk with you more. This is
okay. Just say it again, Peter. What?
Peter Roth.
Yeah.
Peter@heartriver.org. H-E-A-R-T.
Okay, thank you.
River.
I'd love to talk to you some. Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you. It's always great to catch up. I'd love to meet wise people.
Well, you know what? We've had little sufferings. We've had big sufferings. Everybody had sufferings. And what I say, you know, I'm a professor of medicine at NYU Medical School now in medical humanities. It's a great school. And what I talk about when I, you know, I give lots of commencement speeches in medical schools all over the world. And what I talk about is it's not about suffering only. I mean, everybody suffers. It can be big suffering, little suffering. Everybody suffers. It's not the suffering. It's how you walk through it.
Perfect.
And if you try to walk through it alone, you're going to suffer more and you're going to spread more suffering around.
Yeah.
And if you ask for help from caring others, like doctors, which I am one of, you're not going to suffer as much and you're not going to spread more suffering around. Thich Nhat Hanh once said, don't spread more suffering around.
I'm glad he said it.
Yeah, me too.
So we only have about a minute left, and the book is The Buddha's Wife. It's The Path of Awakening Together, and I'm speaking with the author Samuel Shem, and who's missing today is his wife, Janet Suri. Sam, how can people get the book or go online and find a nice website?
So our website is all one word, The Buddha's Wife Book, no apostrophe, thebuddhaswifebook.com.
That's great.
And we need some, you know what, it's 3 weeks old now. And Peter, we have not had, you know, for some reason the mainstream has not leapt at this book. And I think it's
because it's
talking about connection and not self. You know?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sam, for being on the show.
It's such a
pleasure talking with you.
Be in touch. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And all of the listeners, I'd be happy to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening.